Just a quick note before we get started. This episode is part two of a two-part episode about the Francis Ford Coppola film, Bram Stoker's Dracula. If you'd like to hear our thoughts on the whole thing, you may want to go back and find part one first. Also, this is one of the more explicit episodes we've done. It will carry the explicit tag. If you're underage or sensitive to such content, check out our back episodes. We have plenty of other stuff we've done.
Are legendary. Their destinies linked. An ageless myth meets an uncompromising master. Francis Ford Coppola brings an undying legend to life. Dracula. Beware.
An interesting little tidbit to change tracks here. Seward is a morphine user?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
What the hell was that? We just get this scene of him shooting up the first time we see him.
I feel like that was a very 90s thing to do. I had not read the book, so I don't know if that was true to the book or if that was like, you know, a little 90s thing that was thrown in there, because let's face it, at the time, heroin was pretty popular.
One of the other themes that some reviews bring out is that this was happening during the height of the AIDS crisis. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, all of the stuff about blood and dirty blood and, you know, like kind of the paranoia around that, I think also anything involving needles, like, is connected to that as well. So I think it's definitely in there intentionally, and it doesn't feel out of character for Seward.
No, I actually think it fits, and you could see him doing that. It's just interesting that they threw that in there, and it's also a one-off because they never come back to that in any way, shape, or form, except he maybe uses it on Lucy. I'm not sure, at some point. Yeah.
I feel like Lucy dodged a bullet with him. When I first saw that scene, I was like, wow, good thing she didn't get with him.
Well, he still would have been better than Dracula, right? I mean,
right.
So can we go there to the subplot in this film that is not in the book at all?
Yeah,
that is just like wholesale invented. And, you know, I think for a lot of people who are fans of the film, love the sequence where Dracula shows up as this young handsome prince in John Lennon glasses and one of the most beautifully tailored suits ever created on film, and is strolling down cosmopolitan London and runs into Mina in also the best meet cute in any of the Dracula films.
Yes.
The more I watch this, the sillier this becomes, but it also, I think, has some great moments, like introducing the cinematograph and having that within the film is really cool.
Well, it reminded me, I mentioned the Viewmaster Dracula earlier in one of these things, and a lot of the scenes in this movie, including the battle scene where there's just this colored background and stuff like that, remind me of that. And the cinematograph, when they're there, there's also these shadow puppets and stuff like that.
Yeah, I like that.
I loved those little touches. Now, remember, this production company is American Zoetrope, which is named after one of those devices. So I'm not surprised that Coppola threw that in here, but the interesting thing is how fast this meet-cute turns into an affair.
Yeah.
she says, I have a husband and stuff like that in the first meeting. But I think that this is something that a lot of people can relate to. It's like her spouse or whatever is a long way away, you know, in some foreign land. This debonair guy comes in. And it's not just that he's a prince, because remember, Lucy like falls for him too in her own way. And she was engaged to Arthur Holmwood, who's like the richest guy in of the lot. So it's not just that. And you never believe that she falls out of love with Jonathan. Jonathan is like the safe lawyer, like guy who has a career ahead of him, you know, and all that. And Dracula is like the bad boy, like you have the good boy and the bad boy, you know, and like she is kind of in love with both of them at the same time, or at least in love with Jonathan and in lust with Dracula, you know?
Right. Yeah.
Dracula clearly satisfies some kind of a need in her beyond just her being under his hypnotic power, or maybe remember destiny stuff from like the 1400s. But I think that there's another story happening here under the story that is in the book, which is that she is not as openly lustful as Lucy, but she has these darker needs that Dracula can satisfy.
Right.
Yeah, I think that checks out. And one of the things that's interesting about this first encounter of theirs is that it sort of has some back and forth. Like initially, you know, Mina's very guarded and is like, what are you doing following me around? And then she sort of softens, you know, seems like, okay, maybe this guy's not so bad. And then he pulls her into a back room and is about to take advantage of her. And she's saying, no, please stop. And it's very rapey. And then he has a sudden change of heart and is like, no, actually, I'm not going to bite her because I don't want to damn her for all eternity. I think I love this woman. And then the wolf shows up.
But she wants to be bitten. Like, at some point, she wants to be bitten.
Well, we get there, but that it's an interesting scene that has this back and forth for both of them of like Mina being frightened of him with really good reason, and then also drawn to, you know, the power that he has over the animals and this clear, you know, charisma he's just radiating in this scene.
So let's talk about some overacting that's not Keanu. Strangely, Anthony Hopkins like takes it to 11 in this.
Yes, it's,
oh my gosh,
so much scenery eating by Anthony Hopkins, who never eats the scenery.
I think he took it a little too far, in my opinion. And also, I think Coppola let him take it a little too far. He's hilarious, but it's dulled by the fact that they keep the same jokes in over and over. Like the, like, no, I'm just going to stake them through the heart and cut off their head. Like that was good when he said it once, after he said it like for the, as a joke for the fourth time or something. I'm like, okay, we get it. Offending Victorian sensibilities, you know? I liked him. I liked his portrayal, but I just wish that they had cut some of his lines and, you know, he could have toned it down just a smidge, you know?
He was a little over the top. One thing I made note of was how kind of creepy he was. Creepy in the way to where when he first meets Mina, he holds her arms out and gives her a look over. Like, obviously.
Yeah, he's got a dirty old man vibe. Like, definitely,
yes, thank you.
A dirty old man vibe.
There's something charming about Van Helsing in all the other movies we've watched. In this one, yeah, he is kind
of
like...
I think a big difference, though, is in a lot of the other versions, Van Helsing is British, or he's like part of the in-group, and in this version he's clearly an outsider from the old world and sort of straddling the old world and the magic and mysticism and lore of the old world with science that is ahead of the times. And so he kind of has this almost like wizard presence in the story in this version, but with that some eccentricities.
Honestly, as I was watching and observing his character through the film, it kind of made me feel like he was older than he actually was, like minutes, centuries older, if that makes sense, like almost magical, mystical, because he seemed to have an understanding that other people didn't have. around Dracula. Even when he was calling Dracula his arch nemesis, it's like, well, how far back do they really go? The film alludes to the fact that maybe they go back centuries rather than, you know, he's just studied Dracula his whole life as a human being. Like, you see what I'm saying?
Well, and the film sets you up for that because Hopkins appears in that opening scene where he's the priest. So they kind of set you up for this dynamic where, like, the echo through time is this triangle of Dracula, Mina / Elisabetta, and the Hopkins character, who is the true defender of the church against Dracula.
And the narrator. He's also the narrator. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I said I wanted to come back to fangs. Lucy, when they first see it and he lifts up her lip and shows them the fangs coming in, I like how they come in like a second set of teeth, like shark teeth. This is the only film I've ever seen do that, and I think it looks really cool. It's like a really neat way to do vampire fangs.
That makes more sense to me than the way I've seen it done before, where the teeth just like grow into fangs, where it's like a whole other set of teeth that come down.
The final confrontation with Lucy, she like comes back to the crypt with a child, as is in the novel. All the candles spark to life. Power number 900 that vampires have. Which makes a lot of sense, though, when we look back. Remember I said Renfield, his whole full-time job was lighting candles? And it makes more sense if we can just light all the candles when we walk into a room. But there's some stuff that's straight up modern horror film stuff. Like, she spits blood out of her mouth at them.
I love that.
In a projectile exorcist way.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's a direct homage to The Exorcist. They definitely hammer home at this point in time that, like AIDS, it's a bloodborne infection.
Mm-hmm.
Mina finds out that Jonathan Harker's still alive.
The nuns that save him send off for her, so she comes to Romania to marry him.
Yeah, there are rumors that the marriage is actually binding because they hired a real priest and apparently, like, went through all the motions, but I think that's just a, you know, rumor.
Keanu Reeves and Winona Ryder actually had a whole interview where they talked about that. They still, to this day, laughingly joke that they're probably actually really married.
Yeah.
She does say on the train or whatever when she's writing, now that I'm married, I begin to understand the nature of my feelings for my strange friend.
Yeah.
This is the female version, I think, of like that whole Madonna horror complex that like men are said to have. Like, I think for her, it's like seeing the guys that way. Like, there's like the pure guy and then the fun guy. You know, I think that that's kind of the realization she makes on the train, and she's like, okay, now I'm married, so I have to like,
I'm here with the guy, you know, that's good for a long time, and then there's the guy that's good, that's here for a good time, you know. It's like, what's your problem?
Okay, so this is something that I've never understood in any of the Draculas, and in this one I understand it the least. Jonathan knows, like, tells them that maybe I just figured it out myself. Jonathan tells Van Helsing and the rest of the Scooby gang that Dracula lives at Carfax Abbey because he's the one that arranged the sale. He's a lawyer, right?
I know where the bastard sleeps.
I know where the bastard sleeps.
As right, Keanu right. says.
But Dracula goes and kills Renfield and says, you betrayed me. And I always wondered, how did Renfield betray him? You know, although Renfield does tell Mina to get away from Dracula, but other than that, which he was not privy to, as far as we know, I think what it's supposed to be is he doesn't know Jonathan's back yet and assumes that they found him at Carfax Abbey because he's in Carfax Abbey when they come, and he flies out and then immediately goes and kills Renfield. I think he thinks that Renfield's the one that told him he's in Carfax Abbey.
That makes sense.
I think if we go back, if we go back to the book, I bet that is more implied. I think in this one, it still sort of makes sense, you know, that Renfield was bad-mouthing Dracula to Mina and was like, save yourself, run away, like, this guy's awful. And that Dracula's like, you know, you're trying to cock block me here, Renfield, like, get out of my way.
Okay.
And I feel like Renfield was doing that because he was jealous that he didn't get his chance to be one of Dracula's, you know, minions or family members or whatever. He wanted, yeah, he, you know, he was promised.
He promised me eternal life. Yeah.
So we have to talk about the scene where he tries, where he turns Mina or is about to turn Mina, because this is the hot scene I'm talking about. Because this is, mm-hmm, this is even in the book. There's a scene where he cuts his chest and he pushes her down to literally suck him off. Like, yeah, that is the way it is in the book too. Like,
yeah,
this is, it's not just me, right? This is like what they're saying here is going on, right, here, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah, it's, yeah, very steamy. I mean, like, when he comes in under the covers as Mist and then is suddenly, like, full-blown hot guy, like, that's, you know, how a lot of fantasies start out, I think. I'm not alone in that, right?
No, you're not alone in that at all. Yeah, and I mean, and where he scratched himself was even hot. You know, it's like right there, right in the middle of the chest, right next to the knit. Of course, it's hot. You know.
But yeah, you know, even in this, we don't see where her head goes. It just goes down, right? And I don't know. This movie is freaking hot, and like, I found a bunch of the scenes leading up to this hot already. Like, mm-hmm, but this one, whoa. Yeah, but even in the novel, it kind of is, because there's the scene, like, in the novel, they bust in while they're in this act. Like, it doesn't happen in the movie here.
No, it does.
Oh, it
does. I mean, yeah, she's, like, pressed up against his chest, lapping up the blood, and then they come in, and Dracula's already disappeared, and it's just her, like, with blood all over her face, and the mood changes on a dime in this scene. It's really incredible how it goes from steamy, steamy, sexy to, like, oh my god, Dracula is a disgusting monster.
I feel like every other Dracula film we've seen, we either get Dracula as the debonair Christopher Lee type, you know, cape and, you know, handsome. Or we get the Nosferatu creepy deformed creature. But I don't think any of them, we get both until this film. This film was like, yeah.
Vampire in Brooklyn.
Well, yeah. I feel like this version, though, is the most shape-shifting vampire we've seen.
Yeah, but I want to say Vampire in Brooklyn came out after this. So
yes,
this,
yeah,
is the first,
true,
time we get that happening in one film, as far as I know.
Out of all the Dracula films we've watched thus far, I feel like this is the one where Dracula does the most shape-shifting. You know, he goes from everything, you know, from being like this ancient creature creeping around a castle to a werewolf, to a bat hanging in the, you know, hanging in the rafters, to this hot young man who's very, you know, gorgeous and seductive and Mist, you know, like, he's just everything. Gary Oldman can do anything.
Yes.
The whole movie has an air of camp to it also. Of all the films we've seen, this reminds me in some ways more of Lair of the White Worm than it does of any of the other Dracula films.
Yeah, for sure.
Just some final notes is Van Helsing has the cookery in this again. I feel like this movie borrows or steals from all of the previous Dracula films. Like, let's take that from this and that from this and, you know, puts them all together. And of course, it's a Francis Ford Coppola movie. So like all of the Godfather films, religion plays a huge role in it. It starts with God has forsaken me. It ends with we've all become God's madmen. It's kind of like that is a theme throughout.
This is the best version of the chase scene, I think, that we see in the films, where you have the sun setting as this dramatic, you know, ticking time bomb that's coming. Dracula in a carriage in his box of earth is just about to make it to the castle. Mina and Van Helsing are already there. She was sent as a decoy. Didn't work. And she is fully under Dracula's spell at this point and is doing her best to defend him if she can. Jonathan and Quincy and Arthur and Seward are in pursuit, and it's all going to happen. It's all going to come down to the castle. I'm skipping over the part where Dracula's brides eat Van Helsing's horses and then he decapitates them. That's in the book too,
by the way. Yeah.
Yes, which is awesome. But I love just the drama of the setting sun as this is all about to go down. They make it to the courtyard and Jonathan is going to strike the fatal blow and almost succeeds. Dracula pops out of the box and Jonathan is able to run the, I think it's a sword. I don't think it's like a wooden stake the way it is in, does he have a stake? Or I think it's a sword.
What happened in what I saw was they're gonna kill him and cut off his head and all that. And Mina's like, no, would you do that to me?
Well, so they don't cut off his head. I think they get halfway through killing him. Like, they stab him, but he's not dead yet.
I don't think they get him through the heart, whatever the case okay. is. She goes off with Dracula. And this is a moment of revelation for Jonathan, too, because they're like, would you do that to me, too? And I'm kind of thinking, like, in traditional vampire lore, we'd be like, yeah, we would do that to you, too. I could easily see Van Helsing saying that. But
right.
But Harker holds them back. He realizes that this is something she needs to do, that they have this connection, Dracula and Mina, and they have to resolve it on their own. And he allows them, in a really like kind of shocking moment, allows them to go off together and finish it. And to her credit, she does, like, you know, stab him through the heart and cut off his head after they have this last moment together.
And what's interesting is in this version, I'm curious whether you have the same interpretation I do, but I get the sense that Dracula is absolved at the end of this film. Like, yes. You know, the crack in the cross is healed over yeah. and the ceiling painting is kind of illuminated in a way that suggests that God has blessed all of this and everything is forgiven, which I think is fascinating.
Because he sacrifices it. He allows himself to be killed. He sacrifices himself to save her soul, basically.
Mm-hmm.
This is my interpretation. So he is like, okay, you know, I'm gonna like let you go. And I think this is a moment where it's like Jonathan lets her go because he feels like, you know, there is this connection between them and they need to resolve this. He is absolved because he sacrifices her to save her soul. And she is absolved because she chooses to return to humanity rather than to become a vampire and go off with Dracula for all eternity. So everybody sort of gets this cathartic moment of, you know, it's over. You know, we've all satisfied what we need to do.
Right.
Yeah, and he says something like, give me peace, that ultimately yes. that becomes the goal more than sort of maintaining the selfish pleasures or even just like a focus on earthly life, you know, like a love that seems real but is not the highest good.
There's a moment there where you're not sure she's going to do it, right? Like,
yeah,
where you're like, she's just going to go off with him and be a
yeah,
vampire.
Yeah, she's dragging him into the castle, like wielding her sword, being
yeah, she's
like,
the one dragging him in. Yeah, that's the other thing. It's like she's kind of running the show here, right? At the end.
Mm-hmm.
Even though it's got campy overacting and effects and stuff like that, there is something special about this Dracula. This is the best Dracula, I think. You know, this is just the best. And mm-hmm. for all its flaws, it's one of those things where I felt the same way about David Lynch's Dinch. David Lynch's Dune is that that even a bad David Lynch version of something is better than like 90% of other directors, you know, attempts at that same thing. Like, I'm kind of in the same boat with Dune right now. It's like out, everybody's talking about it, but I was a little bit bored with the first one, you know, and I'm like, you know, so I don't know. But with Dracula, I feel like a lot of people have attempted it. This one is not the most true to the novel, and it has a lot of flaws in it. You know, there's a lot of bad acting and like over the top stuff, and but it's still the best. Like, it has its own interpretation, and that interpretation is like no other, you know. Mm-hmm. And it has like Gary Oldman and, you know, Winona Ryder and, you know, Anthony Hopkins, so it's got a great cast,
and Keanu Reeves.
The only thing we didn't touch on that I just want to give one small shout out for is the score in this film is really well done. By a composer who I don't think did anything else, Wojciech Kilar. And this music from this film is used all over the place. If you watch movie trailers where often they're using a score from a previous film to set the mood, this score is used all the time. The dun 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 dun. It's just very, very memorable, well done. And a lot of different music throughout the film. Like the stuff with the dancing scenes, the more romantic scenes where it sounds like a music box playing. Just, you know.
Yeah. Really, yeah. No, really I have this soundtrack in rotation on my streaming services. So yeah, it's definitely something I listen to every couple of months. I'm listening to this.
Yeah.
Practically since it came out. Yeah, that, good point.
And then another thing, I know we touched on the costumes, but I love the costumes in that film. You know, Gary Oldman's whole look when he arrives in London, that look was repeated in the clubs. Remember? How many times did
and
saw guys dressed exactly like that? And then the Crow came out, and then guys showed up dressed exactly like the Crow. But, you know, I'm not going to go there, but it's just like that look set a tone for the 90s.
I'll just say something on what both of you guys mentioned. First, the costumes, which was that some of the more elaborate costumes, particularly at the end scene, look like, and I'm pretty sure they were, based on Gustav Klimt paintings. Yes,
that makes sense to me.
And then as far as music goes, he didn't do any music for the movie, but a musician that I think we didn't mention at all is Tom Waits, plays Renfield, who at the time when I saw this, I'm like, oh my God, because we were into underground music like punk and stuff like that. And those are the only people who knew who Tom Waits were back then. Like, unless you watched a Jim Jarmusch film, you didn't know him as an actor. And I think he deserves a little bit of shout out because he did an interesting job. Renfield. But okay. I think that pretty much wraps things up here. So I want to say, if you like this, just let somebody else know about the podcast. If you want to talk to us or send us an email, it's GC8podcast. That's letter G, letter C, number 8 podcast at gmail.com. Until next time, this is Eric.
This is Rosie.
This is Johanna.
Signing off.
Yeah, so we have Winona Ryder to thank for this film coming to be as it was. She is... Wait, already you want to jump in? You want to jump in like I'm a sentence in?
Already, okay. I want to jump in.